Next on RadioSt.Pete.com, Peter's Proffer with Clearwater attorney Peter Tragos. The experienced lawyers at Tragos, Sartes, and Tragos discuss common legal questions, providing insight into the legal process and covering current events as they relate to the legal field.
Welcome back to another episode of Peter's Proffer here in the courtroom of current events. And today we're going to talk about presidential emergency declarations and what powers come along with that. So we're going to go through some things and some events that have happened in the past that have been declared presidential emergencies, what the presidents used, and what those powers allowed them to do and what they didn't allow them to do. And we'll kind of also talk about what's going on right now with the coronavirus and what Trump was talking about and some of the powers that he mentioned. And we'll talk about what they allow him to do and what other ones may fall into place. So as always, if you want to hear anything, you can reach out to us on social media at Tragos Law is our handle, or you can send me an email, petertragos@greeklaw.com. All right, so today I'm here with Pete Sartes, and we are going to talk about presidential emergency declarations. So everybody knows by now with the coronavirus that Trump has declared a national emergency. That, you know, is kind of a buzzword. Trump said those are big words to use, and we're going to talk about what that actually means. But before we get into it, I do want to talk about that the fact that this has happened like 35 times in the last 30 years. So it's not something that's never happened before. It's not something that, you know, we should be really freaked out about now more than some other time that it's happened. This stuff happens from time to time. And we're going to talk about the fact that these presidential powers have actually come up a lot more than we realize, because they're not always such big news items like they are right now because the entire world is going through it. But just to mention a few, in 2018 alone, Trump has declared an emergency relating to Russian interference in the elections. He's declared an emergency relating to the situation in Nicaragua. In 2017, he declared an emergency. 2015, Obama two times declared an emergency regarding Venezuela in one, and then another one in the same year relating to the Chinese cyber attacks. Obama, again, throughout the years, there's like seven or eight of these on here. They're listed everywhere. There's emergencies relating to Libya, relating to transnational crime, to Yemen, to Russian attacks in Ukraine, to the South Sudan. I mean, throughout the years, when you just go through what Bush, what Obama, what Clinton, and what Trump have declared national emergencies with, I mean, it's been with drug trafficking, it's been things happening in Cuba, it's been terrorist attacks. Obviously, 9/11 was another event that they declared a national emergency. Every time we go to war, it's a national emergency. So this has happened over and over again in America. And the reason for it is it kind of starts the ball rolling to allow the government to do things that they can't do in normal times. We live in a democracy. The government can't stick their hands in our lives as much as they can when there's a national emergency. So that's kind of the first step. And Trump has mentioned multiple times in different interviews on TV, during press conferences, answering questions, he has mentioned the Stafford Act. So the Stafford Act, Pete, why don't you talk about it a little bit? What is the Stafford Act? What powers does it give the president? And why does he mention it in a time like this?
All right. Stafford Act, generally speaking, is an amendment to something called the Disaster Relief Act of 1974. It's named after a senator by the name of Robert Stafford, who was in the Senate from 1971 to 1981. Reason they named after him is because he helped pass it. Here's the 10-cent version. This particular law allows the president the powers to set forth relief and emergency assistance when the nation has a time of need. And it's been used in a lot of different ways over the years. I think my last check, about 56 times since 2000.
Which is a lot. So in
it
the
is
last
a lot.
20 years, 56 times. It's almost three times a year.
So, but let me tell you what it's really
for. We never
for.
Hear about it. I no, mean, we never hear about
well,
it.
Well, we hear about it, but we don't, I guess we don't really think about being the Stafford Act because it happens in times like hurricanes.
Right.
It happens when, you know, the levee broke in, you know, in Louisiana.
So, and again, I think that's something we should mention is the Stafford Act is actually something more appropriate in national disasters versus infectious disease or public health, where it's used in flooding and forest fires and hurricanes, things like that, is usually when the Stafford Act is implemented.
Right. And actually, I did some searches based on what you just said. And the only other time that I could find that the Stafford Act has been used in a medical emergency like this one is back in 2000, Bill Clinton.
West Nile, right?
Yeah, West Nile. That was it.
That's the last time I can really remember it dealing with, you know, public health or infectious disease. But so what does it actually allow the president to do? What powers does it give him?
What it's really designed for is to provide orderly and systematic means of getting federal natural disaster assistance to state and local governments so they can carry out the responsibilities that they have to their citizens. The key to that being is the states, meaning the federal government is taking over an area that is really normally carried on or protected by the state.
And that's a kind of a common occurrence in some of these powers or acts or whatever you want to call them that we go through, is the federal government empowering the states to be able to do what's necessary for their specific state. And the reason it's set up like that, and again, why we talk so much about natural disasters versus public health, is the coronavirus right now is something that's hitting the entire nation, some states worse than others. But when there's a flood or a hurricane, it's usually just one state that it's hitting, right, or two states that it's hitting, which is why the government helps those specific states in those specific instances.
And one of the things you asked is, why are we implementing it in this particular set of facts for the coronavirus? And I'm not sure if this is the best way to do it, but then again, I'm not a politician. But the reality is, this particular law is designed so that if the state governors pretty much determine that they need help because their local resources cannot handle whatever is that's going on, they petition the federal government and ask the president to enact the powers of the Stafford Act so that you can send federal aid and FEMA.
A lot of it has to do with finance.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of it's about money.
Right. The federal government can finance some of these mitigating programs that the states can put on, and they need help financially from the federal government. States don't usually like the federal government to put their hands in the pot that the states are supposed to handle. But in these types of situations, when they need more funding, that's when the federal government can really help. And we should also mention, it's not just natural disasters or times like this. It really is any emergency that this type of act can be enacted. It's even happened in, like I said, terrorist incidents or even mass shootings where the government has been called upon to use the Stafford Act power.
Sure, like Oklahoma City. But, you know, you mentioned mass shootings. The last time a governor asked for some assistance during a mass shooting was here in Florida at the Pulse nightclub shooting. And it was actually denied by President Obama because they felt as if the state resources were sufficient to be able to handle that disaster.
Yeah, so the federal government does an analysis of some kind to figure out whether or not it's appropriate for them to enact the Stafford Act to help the states. And obviously right now with the coronavirus, Trump's going to do that, and the federal government is going to do that. They're going to provide aid to the states in a bunch of different ways. So there's a bunch of different powers that can be used in these situations. Is there anything else you want to hit on with the Stafford Act? Any specifics?
You know, other than really, it can do everything from, you know, evacuation proceedings all the way to traffic control.
But there's one thing that actually is interesting, and I've read some articles on it, is that one of the things it can't do is give the power of the president to lock down the nation or give it a curfew. He can't do it through the Stafford Act. That act does not provide that power to the president. There are other acts that may, but the Stafford Act is actually not one of them. Where Trump was just interviewed and on stage and people asking him questions, and he said that they're not planning on doing that right now. They're not planning on implementing a curfew or a nationwide quarantine or anything like that at this point. But even if they did, it would not be able to be done under the Stafford Act. One act it could be done under is the National Emergency Act, which more broadly defines an emergency and allows the president to take control of certain aspects, such as the internet. It allows for them to take over certain private functions so that they can use it for government purposes, again, to help the nation, to get the message out to the nation, to provide, you know, they could like take over Amazon trucks to help provide food to houses if they had to, or
commandeering
whatever.
Private.
Right. So they, and that gives them powers to do that in emergencies, in certain situations. And Obama used the National Emergencies Act, and I believe took over the internet in 2009 with the H1N1 virus, which was another state of emergency that was declared by Obama where they and used some of these powers.
You know, we talk about it sometimes, and I saw a couple of memes on the internet recently. We've had SARS, we've had Ebola, we've had H1N1. I mean,
HIV,
this happens all the time. This one, I think, is being handled differently because it really is so fast. And
well, it's just a weird one because you also, you don't know if you have it, right? So you're not necessarily exhibiting symptoms. It's affecting certain members of the population a lot more than others. It's affecting certain states a lot more than others. And like you said, it comes so fast. So it goes from nothing to something like that. So people are at the beach, at bars one day, and then the next day you're not supposed to do anything, and people don't believe that. A large portion of society is not going to change their life like that.
By the way, congratulations to West Virginia for not having a single case of of coronavirus.
Yeah. You're
the only one, so good job washing your hands, West Virginia.
Okay, so next let's talk about another tool, I guess we'll call it, in the federal government or president's belt, which is using the National Guard in situations like this.
Yeah, the National Guard has very cool constitutional foundations. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15 of the U.S. Constitution basically says that there are going to be militias, and that's what the National Guard is. Technically, it's a militia, but that militia can be called into federal service in a variety of ways. For example, the president can say, call up the National Guard because he needs them to augment troops. It is a partial mobilization, which is what we have right now. The National Guard in Florida, all the medical units have been mobilized, meaning that all those personnel that are also, 1 week a month, 2 week a year soldiers, they've gotten a notification saying you are now mobilized. You are active right now. If we need you, we can set you going.
And so, we've seen movies or seen it happen in wartime where they have to come and like control the citizens and police the streets. That's not necessarily what they're used for in emergency situations. They are just used to provide assistance. They can be part of the disinfecting or cleaning team. They can provide transportation. They can provide meal delivery like they're doing in other countries right now.
They can do anything, really.
Right. But I mean, I think people think of the National Guard as military and militia, like you're saying, coming with their guns, enforcing a quarantine or a curfew, right? Which they could be used for that. But right now we're far away from that. And they're really more likely to be used providing transportation, providing cleaning and disinfecting, providing actual food. At delivering food, because if you think about it, if we're quarantined, how are people going to get food? And the way they're getting food is the National Guard would deliver it to your house.
Yeah, actually, the National Guard, when it comes to U.S.-based deployments, 9 times out of 10, it's going to be for some humanitarian aid.
Right, exactly. And I think people don't – that's not their first thought when they hear the National Guard's being deployed in the States. Anything else about the National Guard?
If it matters to anybody, it's a 24-month cap. You can't utilize these soldiers for more than 24 months. And as long as the governor consents, the president has full reign and full authority over the National Guard.
Okay, so another act that can be a tool for the president in these kinds of times or the federal government is the Public Health Services Act. And this allows the government to waive certain federal regulations to help get health care quicker and easier to people that need it. It was used to combat the opioid crisis. It was used in H1N1. It's been used in these kind of infectious disease or these situations. It's specific to this, not necessarily for hurricanes, for flooding, for fires, things like that. So that's why it's kind of right down the line for corona and probably will be used, especially if we need more, like they're saying, ventilators, ICU beds, medical personnel. This is the kind of act that they can have certain powers under as well.
Right. And what's interesting is they actually have an entire area of the government, which is set forth under the U.S. Public Health Services Act, which is the U.S. Public Health Service Department. And if you look at, for example, the Attorney General, the Surgeon General, if you've been watching Trump speak in the last few days, you see all these guys in uniform and they're all in these blue uniforms. Mm-hmm. You think they're in the Navy. They're not. If you look at the tags on their uniforms, it says Public Health Service Administration.
Yeah, so I mean, it provides a lot of specific, and these acts overlap a lot. And as you've heard, I've said H1N1 for half of them because all of these acts can be kind of implemented during any individual or multiple emergencies at one time. And then you have situations where the House and the Senate can pass bills much quicker than it usually takes for bills to become law. Like they talked about this most recent one where if you have 500 employees or more, you don't have to do paid sick leave for the amount of time that they take off, trying to let employees take off if they want to or if they just have a cough, but not to cripple certain employers so they don't have to pay the full sick leave if somebody's gone for that long, suspend kind of FMLA stuff, or deal with those regulations that normally might be something you couldn't handle as a business, now letting you handle it because they want people to stay home. They want people to quarantine if they just have a common cold that they normally would come in and work with. And Trump said today that they may be expanding that to small businesses. And so that stuff's kind of fluid. But again, it allows the House and the Senate to do things much quicker in times of an emergency than normally how long it takes with the filibusters and all the rules and the red tape that you have to go through the bureaucracy to make a law.
I was going to say, think about it this way. When they're all coming together for the public good, they can accomplish whatever they want quickly.
Right.
If they don't agree, they can stonewall, you know, right. Democrats, Republicans can stonewall each other forever.
Right. A lot of the bipartisan politics go out the window when we have to come together as a nation. We can get things done and everybody realizes what's important. So things are very fluid. We just want to do a podcast real quick speaking about the laws and the acts that might come into play. You might hear them during some of the interviews, during some of the conferences. So just take a listen. You'll have a little bit more knowledge about it. And if anyone gets enacted, we may come talk about it some more. Things are happening fast. Trump says right now no lockdown, but France's president just announced that they're doing a 15-day lockdown nationwide. So Spain things can too. Change fast. So thanks for listening to this episode. We'll try to provide more information as we get it.
Our name is simple.
Radio.
StPete.com.
Welcome back to another episode of Peter's Proffer here in the courtroom of current events, and we are still stuck on the coronavirus. So new laws, new acts, new stuff keeps happening in response to the coronavirus. We are still a full go here, providing all the services we always provide for our clients. The courts are now only handling things telephonically and by video conference, our depots, hearings, things like that. Trials are canceled, but we're still rolling. So today we are going to talk about the Families First Coronavirus Response Act that's been implemented to help businesses deal with the coronavirus and all the sickness and all the schools closing. So we'll get into what that act is, what it does, and who's going to pay for it when it's all said and done. Thanks for listening in. As always, if you want any topics heard on this podcast, our handle is at Tragos Law on all social media. My email is petertragos@greeklaw.com. Pete Sardis is with me on the podcast today, and we are still talking coronavirus. So just to kind of begin the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, why don't you tell us what this is?
All right. To give a little bit of background, over the course of the last week or so, the House has put together a series of legal and public health benefits for paid leave, testing for coronavirus, public health issues, benefits for children and families in something called House Resolution. It was a bill. Now it's a resolution, 6201. That bill went over to the Senate, I believe, either yesterday evening or maybe the day before, and it was signed by the president today. So let me just tell you, that is lightning fast.
And it's hilarious. And not hilarious, but I mean, it's really something and interesting how much can get accomplished when all of these people work together across the aisle from each other that usually they just like to sit there and fight. But when they actually want to come together and get something done, they can do it. And they can actually do things that are beneficial for this country. And it's proven in times of crisis and emergency times like we're in right now.
Right. The truth is we have no problems in this country. And therefore, we make problems right up. But when it's real, you know, everybody got together and I think did a spectacular job of getting a bipartisan resolution that doesn't have a lot of what we call pork in it. There's not a lot of, actually, there's nothing in it. There's no, you know, special interest projects.
Which they tried to do in some of the other coronavirus bills, but not in this one. So what is the purpose of this? Let's get into the meat of it. Let's talk about, we can skip the OSHA standards and things like that, but let's talk about what it actually means for small businesses, employers, employees.
The real purpose is to,
all businesses, I guess I should say, not just small businesses.
In fact, the purpose is to get relief to the American public because of either loss of money, loss of resources, because of coronavirus issues.
It's relieving some of the stress and some of the financial issues that are created by a virus like this. it's created by the sickness itself and the amount of people that it's affecting and the social distancing that we're supposed to be doing. But it's also affecting businesses, employees, and employers because their kids are now done with school. Florida has canceled school for this year. You're basically not coming back till next year. They're doing some sort of virtual school, some of them. Parents are teaching kids at home, picking up that slack. But that creates a real serious problem in the workforce.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, a lot of us don't recognize how many children depend on going to school so they can have breakfast and lunch. And now that their parents can't take them to school, one of the things that's in this particular Family First Coronavirus Response Act is implementation for children to be able to receive meals that would otherwise not have them because they're not going to school.
Okay, and so that's one of the things that's in the act is to help families provide food for their children.
Right.
Okay, what else is in the act?
There are a lot of details involving benefits that people are available to people. For example, like state-run hospitals and nursing homes. So there are going to be benefits available to residents of hospitals and nursing homes that otherwise would not be available. We talked about OSHA standards. Yes, they're actually relieving and changing some of the OSHA standards for some governmental agencies that are actually not bound by OSHA. They've made some requirements for them. There's extensions on food stamps. There's workers getting temporary relief, for example, if they are sick, and we'll talk about these, I think, in some detail here. But it's kind of well encompassing all walks of life here.
So the major part of it that's going to affect most of the people and what we want to kind of focus on today is dealing with the sick leave and the medical leave and having to stay home to take care of your child or someone else that's sick. So what does it specifically say? It's providing for businesses dealing with people that are sick and dealing with their children that are now home from school or dealing with taking care of a sick person that doesn't have anyone else to take care of them.
And well, I think you pretty much hit the nail on the head. What it comes down to is this particular bill, well, it's not a law, provides sick leave for individuals that are diagnosed with COVID-19. If they have a family member that is diagnosed that requires their time, it applies to them. It also applies to children and other homebound individuals that require care.
So they kind of set out exactly, and we've kind of danced around it. Why don't you read specifically the four things that it sets out for people that would be eligible for the additional leave that is provided for in this act?
Yeah, Section 601 says specifically, worker that has current diagnosis for COVID-19. Number two, worker is quarantined, including a self-imposed quarantine, at the instruction of a healthcare provider, employer, government official to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Number three, worker is caring for another person who has COVID-19 or who is under quarantine relative to COVID-19. And finally, the worker is caring for a child or other individual who is unable to care for themselves due to the COVID-19 related closing of their school, childcare facility, or other care program.
So that's kind of who this act is built to protect and to help. So what are they providing for? And let's just kind of talk about, because there are some limitations in the bill. There are some things that went back and forth between the House and the Senate that were initially requested, such as this be applicable and available for every business, no matter the size, and for every person, no matter what their responsibility is. But it didn't kind of come down the line like that. And there was also, I think they threw all kinds of date ranges around, like, sometimes they talked about doing 2 weeks to make available to employees. Some people wanted 3 months. So it was kind of just across the board trying to deal with this. So what did they come up with? What business size, let's start with, what business size is this applicable for?
This really applies to businesses less than 500 people. I will tell you that there's another break of businesses less than 50 people that has a lot more meat to it. But major corporations like, I don't know,
Walmart,
Fortune 500 companies, right. Yeah, this does not apply to them.
Right. So, and that was one of the things that was argued about, I guess, when this bill was coming up. But it ended up being for small and mid-sized businesses. And it's providing, and the reason it makes sense, because one of the things that they talked about and is in the committee notes was these businesses already have paid leave. They have the FMLA Act, which provides a lot of unpaid leave for medical issues, and they can kind of use the resources that are already given to them, these employees. But a lot of small businesses, especially like you talked about, under 50 employees, they don't provide any sick leave at all. And a whole other chunk of employees that are part-time employees usually don't have any sick leave. Well, this act applies to those small businesses and part-time workers. So why don't we talk about now what it's actually providing? What do you get that isn't that wasn't already provided to you as part of your employment?
Right. Presuming you meet the qualifications of COVID-19 or your family member, you can have 2/3 of your average monthly earnings for a cap up to $4,000. They're also providing this benefit through the end of the year. Retroactive benefits up to 6 months prior to the enactment of this bill for that those wage benefits. The act's kind of, I don't want to say not clear, but it's pretty much says 12 weeks. You get 14 days paid vacation, but it also talks about up to 12 weeks of benefits if you're actually diagnosed and you're stuck.
And for some of the things that it provides for, like caring for a sick child, some portions of it talk about only 2/3 of your salary up to, you know, $200 a day or $500 a day. There are limitations. And additionally, you have to have worked for the company for 30 days prior to even being eligible for this.
Right.
So if you just started last week, you're not eligible for what the Families First Coronavirus Response Act provides. But talk a little bit about, so we've talked a little bit about already, you know, what it provides. It provides 2 weeks of paid sick leave. It could provide even more than that, depending on what your situation is, because a lot of times these businesses don't have that. It also provides 2 weeks additional to whatever your job already provides. So if you take sick leave for this and 2 months from now, this is all gone, well, you still have whatever your sick time and paid time off was that you already had with your job.
Yeah, and think of it as, if you are actually, God forbid, diagnosed with coronavirus or you have a family member that is, those 14 days of sick leave is just for coronavirus. It does not affect your standard 14 days of sick leave just because you got the flu.
So a question that I have for you is, what if your company has less than 50 employees and you find that this just totally jeopardizes your business viability? Are you stuck having to give your employees these 2 weeks paid vacation?
No, and there really is, and this was, I think, really smart, whoever thought of this. There is a provision in the act that basically says, if you are a small business, so under 50 people, and your ability to function and to survive is jeopardized by this, you are exempted. Actually, what I should say is you can request exemption. That way your business doesn't go under.
Right. And they'll allow you to do that. So, and there are some other things and some, it's all fluid. In case you haven't noticed, we've done multiple podcasts on different emergency laws and acts that are happening and coming out in a response to the coronavirus. This is all fluid and things could change and they can make amendments to this bill. But before we get into the last part, which is who's going to pay for all of this, is this just going to be in effect forever? Is this a new law or how are they dealing with it?
This actually sunsets at the end of 2020. So December 31st, 2020, this law ends.
Yeah, and it's over and it's out. And I'm sure they can do another one if, God forbid, coronavirus lasts into 2021. But as far as this iteration of the act, it is over and done with December 31st of 2020. So now let's talk about what a lot of people are probably thinking about. Who's paying for all of this? Are the small businesses stuck with the bill or how's this working?
You know, the truth is when we talk about government spending, we pay for it. We, the citizens, the taxpayers, pay for all of this. And what's happened is...
What he means is we're paying for it in our taxes.
Right.
But in the bill, who's paying for this?
A lot of this money is coming through the Social Security program. That's kind of how it's structured. For all the super nerds out there, they actually made specific line items to protect the Social Security Trust Fund and the administrative budget. So this money does not come from that. But you keep hearing people, especially on the news, talking about these. The government's going to be injecting billions of dollars, actually a trillion, I think is the number the last I heard, of money as a stimulus package. So this is what that money is going to.
So the way that it's working is, these business owners and these employers are going to get full reimbursement for the amount of money that it costs them to have to implement this Coronavirus Families Response Act, and they get it in the form of payroll tax credit. So you apply for that, and they'll give you, the government will give you a credit on what you usually pay for your taxes to the government on your payroll. They'll erase that as part of paying you back for this. But then they will also cut you a check, is what it says, based on the overage if you owe more money to your employees in sick leave than your payroll taxes are. So you're going to be fully reimbursed for all of the sick leave, all of the time off for taking care of children that you have to provide for your employees.
And from the employer's perspective, understand that for every employee, your boss pays an additional about 12%, give or take, of taxes on top of your actual salary, and that is your payroll tax. And what the government's going
to
do is It
goes to
the government, absolutely. It is nothing more than a tax for you to be able to work. And what will happen is, like Peter said, you'll remove from your payroll tax calculation the amount of dollars the sick or, you know, COVID eligible employee consumed. Now, for some companies, they're too small and the 12% will never add up. So they're the ones that are eligible for a check.
Well, and for some companies that are going to be in that part that apply for exemption, like you talked about, less than 50 employees, that this is going to jeopardize the viability of their business. I also read, and some people commentating on the act and some other experts that have been kind of shooting around how this is going to work, that the government has also talked about ways to front that money to businesses. So, and there's a couple different ways you can do this. So the government can actually send you a check, like some of the experts have talked about that might happen as a result of this act. But then we also have been getting emails from some of our business bankers and financial planners that Florida is it Florida or was it the federal government?
It's federal government, $50,000 interest-free loans.
Correct. So they're giving $50,000 interest-free loans that you do have to pay back. But the way you could do it is, you know, not finagle, but it could be a process where you get the $50,000 loan, you use that to pay for all the coronavirus sick time, and then the government reimburses you and you pay back that loan. So it's kind of just money going around in a circle that lets you float because, again, some businesses that have less than 50 employees can't just float a couple months of paid sick leave for all of their employees while they're not making money.
Right, because we call it cash flow, meaning the monies that go in and out of a business are suffering right now. So that cash flow is what that part of the bill is designed to protect, keeping businesses flush with cash. That way they can keep paying their employees, keep their doors open. And we'll see, frankly, how many more things are going to come out of this. One of the things that we didn't talk about, and I should probably mention, there is even an entire section of unemployment benefits that are going to be set up. And these unemployment benefits you can apply for electronically. So as opposed to going down to the unemployment office and, you know, filling out your forms, they're going to be online, or you can call or email, which is unprecedented for the government.
And they're going to make the process a lot easier because they realize a lot of employers are going to have to lay off their employees. Some employers are even doing it as a favor to the employees, that as opposed to just sending them home with no pay, you lay them off or you fire them so that they can go get unemployment.
Right.
And the government is going to kind of uptick, you know, or I should say loosen their strict terms of giving people unemployment. Now they're going to give it a lot easier because they realize all these people are getting laid off because there's no work because of the coronavirus, especially with hotels and tourist activities and
casinos
are services,
closed, food
yeah,
service,
restaurants,
sure.
All that stuff is really going down. So they're going to make it easier for you to get unemployment. So the last part of the bill that's going to affect a lot of people is how are they going to make it easier and cheaper for you to figure out if you have the coronavirus?
First things first, I think we're going to start seeing tests and testing really get streamlined here in the next, hopefully, few days. The interesting part about the bill is the health provisions that are inside of it, and it talks about Medicare, Medicaid, TRICARE, that's insurance for us military folks, and private health insurance are now all mandated and obligated to cover coronavirus testing, of course, if you qualify, and treatment with no cost to the individual. So there's no copay for
that. Right. There's no copay. There's no deductible. There's no out-of-pocket. There's no nothing.
Right.
Your insurance is going to cover all of this coronavirus stuff that you have. Hopefully it's just a test test comes back negative, you go home. But if the test comes back positive, then again, your insurance is going to have to cover it. It's not going to be something that goes through all the red tape and are they going to cover this? Are they going to cover part of it? Are you going to have to pay this much out of pocket while you're not working and not getting paid? Or while you own a business that's losing money, they don't want to add this on top of that. So the government's doing what they can to help.
And I'll tell you, to talk about how much they thought this through, which was really impressive, it even includes what we call durable medical goods. For example, let's just say you're immunocompromised and your doctor says you need to have a specific type of respirator mask. It will cover that as a durable piece of equipment that you need to either to protect you or others from the virus.
Right. So, and this is the time where the government can come in and kind of help the people of the nation.
I was going to say one thing that I find very interesting about this, and not to, you know, make light of a pandemic, but there are 300 million people in this country. As of today, I think we've got 10,000 people that are diagnosed.
We're recording this on Thursday, March 19th. So it's going to be a little earlier. You're going to hear this a little later than we're recording it. So the number will be higher, I'm sure, then.
Yeah. But, you know, when you think about how much effort is being undertaken on a virus that basically affects a very small percentage of the population, but how much effort has gone on into, you know, protecting us from this. You know, it's frankly kind of scary. The question is, what are we missing?
Yeah, and not just what are we missing, but also the other things that could be fixed if both sides would work together, if the Republicans and Democrats could actually come together and compromise here and there to try to help people that need to be helped, but not hand out unnecessarily for people that don't want to help themselves kind of deals. You know, it's kind of just the government coming together and trying to get things done where everybody can agree, because you can see rational minds can agree, which is the opposite of the saying. Usually it's rational minds can disagree. But rational minds can actually agree even when they don't see eye to eye on all the issues, when it's necessary and when it's actually the right decisions are being made.
Right. And we talk about these people sometimes not very well, but you know, they're smart. And
they even
came to a point, and it's in this, the kind of the back end of this, of the act, they've even made provisions for fraud. So if at some point you are discovered to be committing fraud, there are special provisions that take place to prosecute people that are taking advantage of coronavirus.
That's like I hire my daughter, have her work here, send her home, she can collect, and then I collect that back from the government. Now we just made double money. You know, that's, I'm sure there's elements of fraud that you can come up with, just like in any other law that's benevolent to the people of the country. And that's what we're always worried about as well. But you just see what can happen when politicians take the politics out of decision making and just try to do what's right. So hopefully this act will help a lot of businesses. Hopefully it'll help a lot of employees. And hopefully you learned something in the podcast today. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back with you next time. I think I've already failed the recommendation that we speak slower in the podcast so it's easier for people to follow. And as we go, our marketing coordinator told us that we need to speak a little slower so it's easier to follow. So Pete, we're going to do our best to do that today.
You've been listening to Peter's Proffer with Clearwater attorney Peter Trakos. The experienced lawyers at Tragos, Sartes, and Tragos discuss common legal questions, providing insight into the legal process and covering current events as they relate to the legal field. Find out more at tragoslaw.com.